Welcome to KGN News Morning Magazine. It's Monday, July 24th of 2023, and I'm your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Coming up on today's program, a Bureau of Land Management campaign to sterilize wild horses may have larger ecological impacts on the landscape and fire risk. Here's why. And the CityCast crew sat down with Colorado's former state historian about what to expect from Denver's new mayor. After the BBC News headlines, we'll hear the latest commentary from Jim Hightower. Then it's a public affair, hosted by Jim Williams of the Community Foundation of Boulder County. At 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look into fairness and accuracy in reporting. And at 9:30, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all coming up, but first, the headlines from KGNU's Benita Lee.
A Denver rights organization run by unhoused people is warning that Mayor Mike Johnston's declared state of emergency could be used to further marginalize people living on the streets. In a press release Sunday, House Keys Action Network Denver, or HAND, said that while the emergency declaration could open up resources for aid, it could also increase the sweeps and the criminalization of the unhoused. HAND urged that efforts go towards permanent housing solutions rather than controls that might simply move people who camp in the city to, quote, hidden areas, shelters, out of town, or jail in order to create the appearance that houselessness is decreasing, unquote. Johnston built his winning mayoral campaign on the promise of ending homelessness. Last week, one of his first acts as mayor was to issue the emergency declaration, calling the situation a, quote, humanitarian crisis. State law requires that council approve an extension so that an emergency order can last beyond 7 days. The Bureau of Land Management has issued a proposal rule primarily focused on fiscal reforms to the federal oil and gas leasing program. Emily Cicillo has more.
The draft rule includes some considerations for protecting wildlife habitat and cultural sites. However, critics, including the Western Environmental Law Center, point out that it doesn't go far enough to address the climate crisis ramifications of the oil and gas leasing program. The environmental nonprofit notes that the climate-related aspects only received one mention in the 322-page document. Some stakeholders also believe stronger and more explicit measures should have been included to ensure better protection for these important aspects. For KGNU, I'm Emily Cicillo.
Colorado Parks and Wildlife announced Friday that a river ranger saved 3 people on the Arkansas River earlier this month after their boat flipped on rapid waters. KGNU's Yvonne Olivas has more.
According to a Colorado Parks and Wildlife press release, Ranger Jeff Hammond carried out a dramatic nighttime rescue of 3 people in dangerous waters. Hammond received a call from the Chaffee County Sheriff's Office at approximately 10 p.m. on July 6th. 3 people had been flung into dangerous waters in Browns Canyon, a 13-mile-long gorge. Hammond, accompanied by a search and rescue team, rode an ATV at the river's side until hearing shouts for help. He spotted the victims and lowered his kayak into the water, making his way through the whitewater in darkness. After locating the 3 people, Hammond paddled them across the river until they reached the ATVs, who took the group back to safety. The experienced river ranger said it was an unnerving experience. He advises that in situations of distress, rafters call search and rescue sooner than later to avoid extreme mishaps. This has been a particularly dangerous season on Colorado rivers, with at least a dozen fatalities. Park officials have said heavy rain and a longer snow runoff are creating faster flowing waters. For KGNU, this is Yvonne Olivas.
40% of people in Colorado and Wyoming are in need of food assistance. KGNU's Zach Thompson reports.
According to a survey from the Food Bank of the Rockies, rising inflation and the end of COVID-era federal relief programs are contributing to the widespread food insecurity. Food insecurity disproportionately targets lower-income households and marginalized communities. Experts say children who experience food insecurity have higher rates of asthma and poor general health. Not having access to affordable food is associated with higher blood pressure, cholesterol levels, anxiety, and depression in adults. For every $1 donated, the Food Bank of the Rockies says they could provide 3 meals. Prior to her first show in Denver, Taylor Swift donated 75,000 meals to the Food Bank of the Rockies. For KGNU, I'm Zach Thompson.
Fort Collins, Longmont, and other cities along the Front Range are spraying pesticides in mosquito-infested areas to combat high numbers of the insects and to prevent the spread of West Nile virus to humans. The virus was discovered this month in mosquitoes in Boulder, Larimer, Weld, and Delta counties. There have been no human cases reported in Colorado so far this year. State health officials have been monitoring the insects to determine which areas to spray to avoid potential spread of the disease. West Nile is transmitted to humans by female mosquitoes infected with the virus. Officials say that although most infections are mild, some can lead to serious complications such as meningitis, vision loss, and paralysis, or even death. The virus can lead to flu-like symptoms such as fever, headache, and body aches. Residents who wish to opt out of spraying in front of their homes can submit a request to VDCI, the mosquito management contractor used by Longmont and Fort Collins, at vdci.net/Colorado. The city of Boulder closed its first application window for e-bike vouchers Wednesday. The program, inspired by Denver's successful e-bike rebate pilot program that started up last year, received a lot of attention. A grand total of 1,207 individuals applied for 200 e-bike vouchers. Recipients were chosen at random. The city approved 100 standard e-bike vouchers and 100 income-qualified vouchers. The city will open a second application window in September. The Boulder County Housing Authority broke ground last week on the future site of 400 new affordable homes in Lafayette. Boulder County Commissioner Claire Levy said Willoughby Corner development at the corner of Emma and 120th Street will be the largest neighborhood in the state with zero emissions. The neighborhood's design features solar, geothermal, and other sustainable technologies. The first phase will include rental apartments for adults 55 and older and is scheduled for completion next summer. For-sale affordable homes are also in the plans, plus green space and trails. It will be mostly sunny with a 20% chance of afternoon thunderstorms today. In Boulder, a high near 96 and a low around 68. In Denver, a high near 99 and a low around 68. In Fort Collins, a high near 98 and a low around 63. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm Jimmy Searfoss. The Bureau of Land Management is continuing its efforts to remove wild horses from Colorado public lands this summer. This comes about a year after advocates and legislators pleaded for the BLM to stop helicopter roundups of hundreds of wild horses in the Sand Wash Basin. This summer, the BLM has recruited volunteers to shoot hundreds of wild horses with sterilization shots in an effort to eventually remove what they say is an excess of about 100 wild horses on public lands in northwestern Colorado. Alexis Kenyon spoke with William E. Simpson, a wild horse ethologist, CEO of the Wild Horse Brigade, and one of the few wild horse researchers in the country.
When you start going out there and randomly shooting animals with sterilization chemicals is what they are. They're not contraception. They're a sterilization chemical, Gonicon and PZP, that are listed by the EPA as pesticides, and they're using them off-label. They are not like the contraception that was developed over decades for humans and subject to tons of clinical trial.
Oh, wow. Does the sterilization make them sick?
Well, it does. And if you happen to treat her with sterilization chemical like PZP or Gonicon, what you're doing is you're interfering with the life cycle of this family of horses, and it actually interferes with natural selection, which preserves the vigor of the species, critical for the survival of these animals. I mean, it's very critical. So yeah. Do wild horses have that much time left? The answer is no, they do not. You know, wild horses, if we keep doing what we're doing right now, in 20 years, there won't be wild horses. They'll be gone. There'll be a few scattered groups here and there in zoos and a couple sanctuaries here and there. We won't have the elegance of wild horses gracing the natural landscape. That will be gone.
Okay, let's talk about horses and fire management. You have a quote that I read from a story you did with NPR, and the quote was, keeping horses out of the wilderness and in confinement is like putting the fire department in jail during fire season.
It is.
Tell me about that. What did you mean?
Well, it comes right back down to William J. Ripple from Oregon State did a study. It was on five continents, and I think there was like 30 universities involved. It's called The Collapse of the Large Body Herbivores. And he's got a whole section in there on fire. And what it says is that the essence, the takeaway is on every continent where they looked at the collapse of the herbivory, you know, in Australia, they killed 4 million kangaroos. That was their natural, that was their large body herbivore there. On every continent they looked at where you have a collapse of the large body herbivore, catastrophic fire evolved. Every time. So this isn't like some sort of a mystery. I mean, this is well-known science. It's well-published, settled science. When you get rid of your native species herbivore, the deer, the elk, the kangaroos, depending on where you are, all that grass that's growing that was feeding them, it just sits there. There's nothing. Fire will eat it. Yeah. And if you lose your herbivores, it will be fuel for the fire instead of for the herbivores.
Right.
For them to live. And you know, we're talking 3.5 million tons of grass and brush that sits there now, waiting for the first lightning strike or some crazy human behavior, train chain dragging, power line down. The point is sources of ignition we can't control. What we can't control is the fuel load.
Yeah.
And we do that by getting these horses out of confinement, put them into these private wilderness and public wilderness areas, and you release them there. And what do? They do what they've done for 4 million years. They reduce the fuel. They make it safer for the trees. When you have a fire, then it burns low and slow. And that's the natural fire that the indigenous talk about we need.
Yeah. I mean, in Colorado, it's been raining all summer, which is very unusual. But what's the most concerning is, you know, when the Marshall Fire happened here a couple years ago, one of the biggest factors that we heard about was there was a lot of fuel on the ground because we had had a really wet spring. And I feel like with this summer being even rainier than that year, I think people are scared. They're worried.
You should be. Yeah, having a lot of rain is great for the aquifer. But then what happens is you get a lot of fuel, and because mankind has been very good at wiping out our large body herbivores in North America. You know, we went from tens of millions of bison when Columbus showed up, and then we ended up killing them down to where we had less than 500. People need to get a pencil and start doing math. I mean, we're spending about $250 million a year in taxpayer money to feed horses in captivity, wild horses that have been rounded up by the BLM and forest. They're held off range, and it's kind of like a FEMA camp, and we're feeding them grass hay. You know, the solution is, it's really a no-brainer. Maybe that's why people are missing it. It's right in front of their nose, and they can't see it. Nature's perfect. We have to stop fighting nature and start looking at how nature does things, because then we win. Nature wins, and then we win too, because we've forgotten we're part of nature. We're part of this planet. We're above it. We're not exempt from what's happening on this planet. And we always think we can do it better than nature. That's not true. We've shown time and time again that we bungle it. Every time we try to do something, we screw it up royally because we're affected by ego and money.
William, thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
William E. Simpson is a wild horse ethologist and CEO of the Wild Horse Fire Brigade. For KGNU, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
Robert Speer, Michael Hancock, Benjamin Stapleton, Federico Pena, Wellington Webb, each mayor of Denver leaves their mark on the city, for the good, the bad, and often for both. So what can we expect from Mike Johnson? How will his administration bend the arc of Denver history? CityCast Denver host Bree Davies and producer Paul Caroli sat down with Nikki Gonzalez, a professor of history at Regis University and former state historian, to help us set expectations for the Johnson era.
So, Nikki, you were born and raised here in Denver. You're a former state historian. Feels like you are perfectly suited to help us get a little bit of perspective on this moment of transition from Hancock to Johnston.
I feel a lot of hope, but I think even more so the historical moment. It could be a transition, you know, from one person to another, not really mattering who those people are, but rather just after 12 years, new blood at the top. And it's really the kind of the magnitude of changes that this new mayor is going to confront that I think has some precedent in history if we look back. So, I mean, just to have, you know, after 12 years, some new, fresh perspectives, because I think that if you look at the last 12 years, Denver is such a different city than it was 12 years ago. And so looking back, I would probably compare it to the time period of World War II and the rapid changes that came to the city of Denver to compare as far as the enormity of change that the city has been through and the new challenges that the new mayor is going to face.
I'm so interested in this parallel. Like, what was the shift at that time, that post-World War II, like, population-wise, it was an influx of a lot of people, kind of like what we've experienced, right?
It was.
But what else do you see there as a parallel?
Just the changing of the landscape of the city. So as a result of the war, we have war industries and certain industries that were feeding the war effort. So for example, the rural to urban migration into the city of Denver was huge. Historians estimate that between 1940 and 1950, the population of Denver itself grew about 29%. People are coming to the city from rural areas in southern Colorado and northern Colorado, also New Mexico, to work in industries like Gates Rubber Company, which was producing, you know, parts for some of the munitions, and also Remington Arms Plant, which is now the Federal Center at 6th and Kipling, but which drew people into those war industry jobs, as well as, you know, growth in the agricultural industries and processing of food and meatpacking. So you see people coming for economic opportunity. The U.S. government is even recruiting workers, laborers from Mexico as part of the Bracero program. And so the whole landscape, both demographic and physical, of Denver will change during those war years.
Man, I have so many thoughts, Paul.
Tell me about
it. It's like blowing my
him.
Mind. Well, I'm also just thinking about, so Paul lives in the neighborhood I grew up in Virginia Village, built in the 50s. My house there was built in 1954. This is like a direct correlation to that growth, was these neighborhoods were being built. And it's making more sense now that you're making that parallel. Like, that was the growth we were seeing. And also industry. We don't talk a lot about industry here, how it impacts Denver and Colorado the same way as I think about, like, you know, a city like Detroit or somewhere where that is so dominant. But you're right. That was Gates Rubber, I think, for folks that don't know, that was along Broadway. Along South Broadway, it was a massive employer and just a massive building. It was an integral part of our city's identity.
I mean, I feel like the obvious parallel with the last 10 years, the Hancock years, is the tech boom we saw.
Yeah.
And all of the energy downtown. I mean, right now it's hard to imagine a downtown that was like buzzing and vibrant, but I think the Hancock years downtown really did have that feeling. And it was all these young, affluent people moving here for these high-paid, high-power tech jobs. So yeah, I mean, I can see the shape of the city really. I mean, we talk about it all the time. Downtown, no one's going back there. All these office buildings are underutilized, and like, is that going to be a big commercial, you know, real estate crunch that we're heading into? But it's reshaping the city, like you're talking about. That's so interesting.
Our dream of Denver is refusing to abandon our city center, but instead promising to reimagine it as centers of commerce and culture, art and music, where all of us can live and work and play, to build industries that manifest the creativity of our diverse entrepreneurs, that showcase what makes us different and what makes us Denver, and spaces where all of us feel seen and safe and celebrated.
Let's talk more about this tension between population growth and economic prosperity, because that feels like the actual biggest story of the day here in Denver, is this change from when we had 10 years of population growth to now, and maybe it's slowing down, maybe even declining. Johnston is going to be the steward of that, whatever is to come. Does that sound like a decline speech? Is he managing decline? Is that what you all heard?
I heard that he was acknowledging the frustration and the struggles of many folks who have been here for a long time, who have not reaped the benefits of that growth, that explosive growth time. It felt like a real, an acknowledgement of the reality that I didn't often hear from Hancock, which was acknowledging our reality as people living here. Can we afford it? Can we afford our own city anymore? Which was not the same conversation 12 years ago.
Sometimes when I hear Mike Johnston talk, I don't always hear him do the thing that Hancock was so good at, in my opinion, which is speak to the aspiration and point to that direction forward and like pushing us to that next higher level. I mean, Johnston's big talking point is he wants to make Denver one of America's best cities. Hancock said he wanted to make us a world-class city.
I want to hear from you, Nikki, because this is where Paul and I extremely diverge. I'll say more, but I want to hear from you.
I sensed a little bit of a reality, kind of a sense of reality from Johnston. So I've been kind of paying attention to his transition team and how he's created different committees to address issues like homelessness, mental health, well-being, in the different neighborhoods. And so my sense is that he's looking at these issues, which are very deeply rooted. There are no easy solutions here. And he's really relying on experts in the community. And I think my sense is that he will listen to those people to address those issues. You know, one of the things that I thought of, Paul, when you were talking was when Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, gave his inauguration speech. Right afterwards, he was sitting with his son, and his son was helping him take off his leg braces. And he confessed to his son, he said, "I have no idea what I'm doing." And he said, "You know, I've said this thing about a New Deal, right?" And he had no idea what that New Deal would look like. But what his genius was, and this, he's not a mayor, he wasn't a mayor, but he was an executive leader. He was very good at putting people around him who were the experts. And that's how he governed. And so I almost see, not that I'm comparing Mike Johnston to FDR, but I almost see the same process.
I agree with you. He's building that. Who are my experts who can speak to or at least connect with the things that I just don't have any experience with, or that's just not my story? But Paul, I do want to go back to this thing that you and I push back and forth on, which is that the world-class city thing that Hancock always pushed never resonated with me. It felt fake and for someone else. It didn't ever feel like for me as a Denverite. And so the fact that Johnston really said that, deliver Denver as America's best city, I was like, I feel like we're being pulled back down to earth for the first time and being like, here we actually are. This is the ground level that we're working from. And we want to get to this next step before we go 100 feet high.
So speaking of this America's best city line that Johnston has been repeating, when he said that on Monday in his inauguration speech, I couldn't help but think about my favorite science fiction writer, Kim Stanley Robinson. Are either of you familiar?
No.
Okay. He had a book that was on one of Obama's like favorite of the year lists a couple years ago. That's probably his claim to fame. But that's not the book I want to talk about. The book I want to talk about is his novel, New York 2140, in which he imagined a world where a climate changed world where New York City has been flooded and, people are going up and down the boulevards on boats. And in this world, Denver is the financial capital of the United States. That's what he predicted for this world. So is that our path to becoming America's best city? Is it, all the other cities get flooded and drowned or, wildfired?
I hope not. But Denver has, to me, what I've said this before on the show, what makes Denver great is what happens when no one is looking. So when we want to get the work done, we put our heads down and we do the work and we become the city that we want to be. And I think that's why we've consistently been a place that people flock to. It just goes back to my feeling that we don't need to be so big. We don't have to think of ourselves so big. We just have to enjoy and respect who we are.
I would agree with that. I think our definition of great, shouldn't be tied to size, but to the values that we live by. And I felt like, I appreciated that Johnston talked a lot about values and how we treat one another. And I really think that if we set that foundation in the beginning, we will become a great city because of the way we treat each other. And I feel like we might have the building blocks, a strong city council, strong populace, and a mayor who I think will listen. We might be on our way to making some progress in that area.
Nikki Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us.
This was lovely.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, we love your perspective, Nikki. Thank you so much.
That's all for The Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Special thanks to Benita Lee, Ivana Levis, Poor Jaijong Keep, Kira Zizzo, Zach Thompson, Emily Sosilo, Alexis Kenyon, Shannon Young, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. If you'd like to leave a comment on something you've heard on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday during The Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for the commentary from Jim Hightower, then it's a public affair with Jim Williams. That's just after the news update from the BBC.